Lecture 10. Melville. Moby Dick. Part 1.
Welcome, folks, to Moby Dick. To try to do justice to this gargantuan book, it is the 800-pound gorilla in the American canon, in two lectures is going to be probably impossible. But one thing I can say is that you will notice that we are moving from the kind of organized frames, in particular the sort of thing we saw with the Bildungsroman, or the novel in general, as we know it, is a story of an individual against a social backdrop, into something quite different. We could call it From the Bildungsroman into the Deep Sea. Moby Dick essentially explodes what most people think a novel should be, and it's not clear that a novel is the right term to use for it. I love the book. There are people who can't bear it. It's not clear that it has a whole lot of women readers. There's certainly no women in the book, and I'll talk about that. But I think it's the most generous book in American literature, and that's because I think Melville has the most generous, robust imagination among American writers. It seeks to measure the immeasurable, which of course can't be done, but it can be attempted. It has a kind of eloquence. It has metaphysics, which is not something we've seen a lot of. We saw some of it in Wuthering Heights, but not so much in the other novels, and not so much in general in novels. Social notation is quite a different thing from metaphysics. It has also humor, which I think people need to discover and enjoy to realize that Moby Dick is not such a heavy read. And it has chutzpah, more than any book I know. So if it's no longer self versus society, which is the traditional sort of gambit of the novel, it's this time man, or to put it in more general terms, the human being in the universe. So Moby Dick is the American text that enters this course, and I'd argue that Moby Dick is the American text that enters world literature too, that establishes itself in world literature while challenging a lot of the canons about what literature is supposed to be. We'll see more of this kind of thing when we do Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, writers who challenge again the kind of more narrow, staid precincts of what a fiction would be and bring in metaphysics or lyricism or philosophy. There is a kind of marked, tragic curve to Melville's art. He became a remarkably popular writer, writing this bestseller, Typee, in the early 1840s, about his own adventures in the South Seas, about his sort of skirmishes with cannibalism. And this immediately sort of gained him a reputation, essentially as the man who lived among cannibals. And each book that he writes after Typee becomes less picturesque, less exotic, and more philosophical. And then in Moby Dick, which we think of as his masterpiece in 1851, it is the kind of fullest expression of all that Melville is ever to do. It has still some of the adventure elements of the tall tales of the earlier books. It has a huge dosage of the philosophy and the metaphysics that are coming into those books. And it was thought to be more or less unreadable. It sank him, to use a nice maritime metaphor. It sank him, it lost him his readership, and yet one of the ironies, of course, of history, one of the sweet things about history, didn't do Melville any good, is that we keep him alive, at least in some sense, by finding this book so fascinating and so valuable today, many, many, many years later, more than a century and a half. Because after Moby Dick, Melville begins to go downhill. He continues to write short stories, some of which are brilliant, in the 1850s. And then after the 1850s, he continues to live, but he becomes more or less a ghost, sort of disappears from the literary scene, and sort of pops up again in the late years of the 19th century with Billy Budd, which is a very sort of well-known late Melvillian autumnal story. Well, what explains this curve? I mean, why does a guy go from an extraordinarily popular, successful writer of adventure yarns to a dead weight, to a ghost? Let me talk about some of the things that are in Melville and that are at their fullest and at their richest in Moby Dick. Melville is responding to the legacy of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was really the great architect, it seems to me, of American literature and American thinking in the early 19th century. Emerson's essays started appearing from the 1830s on. And in particular, Emerson calls for a new indigenous American literature. And it's hard for us, with our distance from this period, to realize what a bold call that was. But you have to realize that there was no such thing as American literature per se in the 1830s. the literature that was written in English was English literature, that American literature didn't really have its own stamp in the same way. There had been a few writers like Washington Irving, Benjamin Franklin, but Emerson wants a literature that really is through and through an indigenous form of expression. And also, Emerson has what one has to call a kind of religious dimension to his thinking. It's philosophical, but it's also religious. He believes that the material world, the world of nature, the world of things, is saturated with spirit, with soul. He coined the word oversoul. And he thought that artists, in a sense, tap into that, that writers and poets tap into that soul, which is in, but also exceeds any of the individual items where we might find it. And you could argue that the act of reading is, in a sense, a kind of communion with this oversoul. I think that there's that same feeling in Melville, that it's not a reaction against materialism, but it's a view that the material world, the phenomenal world of surfaces that we all see, the empirical world, is suffused with something beyond matter, with spirit, with energy, not necessarily with God, but with something that you want to also bring to expression in your writing. Further, there is a political component in Emerson's work, which is to celebrate American democracy as a new social and political form. And heaven knows that is a kind of message, and I would argue a kind of myth, that we continue to believe in today, that we continue to celebrate today, and it's a reason why people still want to come to the shores of this country. Obviously, there have been many debates back and forth on that as to whether it is a myth or whether it's a dream or whether it's been degraded or not, but nonetheless, there is a powerful democratic element in Melville. He's not quite a chauvinist, but he's not all that far from it. So Moby Dick appears in 1851, and people have called the 1850s in American literature, the Renaissance. There's, in fact, a well-known book by F.O. Matheson called American Renaissance, because it's sort of astonishing to realize that The Scarlet Letter and Moby Dick and Walden and The Leaves of Grass by Whitman were all written within a five-year period. It's as if there's a kind of explosion on the literary scene, because they all, in a sense, are the new kind of literature, particularly, I think, Thoreau, Whitman, and Melville. Hawthorne's a slightly different case. So here is a text that is a kind of indigenous American text. It wants to get clear, as Emerson urged, it wants to get clear of the European and classical standards by which literature was earlier produced. That in itself, you have to realize, is a sort of unusual thing. In the 18th century and earlier, the idea of being an original writer would not have made any sense. In fact, it would have been a criticism. You were supposed to follow the rules, follow the prototypes, to show that you understood the tradition. In Melville's case, you've got something so new that it was, in fact, more or less unreadable. Now, he didn't write Moby Dick simply because he had read Emerson. There were two other even more crucial encounters that actually happened around 1850. One of them is that he, rather late in his life, discovers Shakespeare at this time. And that's almost an immeasurable encounter, because Shakespeare gives him a kind of extraordinarily sublime oratorical register, which is almost incompatible with what we think of as fiction. I mean, if you look at Balzac, you're not going to find anything like that. Emily Bronte has a little bit of it, a kind of rich, full, figurative, metaphorical discourse that easily yokes together the ridiculous and the sublime, and that is absolutely sort of filling up Moby Dick, and particularly in the character of Ahab. This enormously vital, almost no holes barred, overflowing kind of writing. At the same time, we're going to see that Moby Dick has a very powerful vernacular punch to it. It's a robust book. So one encounter is Shakespeare. There are soliloquies in Moby Dick. You don't find soliloquies in the novel, but there are in Moby Dick because there are in Shakespeare. And the other person that he meets is a living person, not a dead writer, and that's Nathaniel Hawthorne. He reads Hawthorne's work in 1850, and he gets to know Hawthorne as his neighbor in 1851 in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. He is obsessed with Hawthorne's work. He finds that Hawthorne is a great example of a kind of integral American writing. When I say integral, a writing that has integrity in the sense that it rejects the marketplace. It's a writing that is true to spirit and to soul. It's written by a writer who himself is aloof, a writer who is pursuing his own particular gambit, dancing to his own tune. And the enthusiasm that Melville felt for Hawthorne is on show in one of the reviews he wrote for Hawthorne's work, but also in the letters that really are impassioned, almost embarrassing letters that he wrote to Hawthorne, because Hawthorne was a very shy and I think protective kind of figure who really could not reciprocate Melville's feelings. And so that it's a kind of one-sided friendship, but that's okay because it was a productive friendship anyway for Melville. It helped, I think, to sort of generate this extraordinary novel that we call Moby Dick. Now, Moby Dick, let's talk about it more in particular now. It celebrates American themes in a way that no novel earlier really had. For example, instead of having kings and queens and princes, the kind of figures that you would find in classical literature as heroes, the hero that's presented, at least one of the heroes that's presented in this book, is the Nantucketeer. Now, who in the world, outside of somebody living in Massachusetts, would have thought that there could be such a thing as a Nantucketeer? Well, these are the fellows from Nantucket who are whalers, who go on the whaling boats and the whaling missions. And Melville wants to get it across that these people are as important, have as much stature as the kings and queens of old. That they are creatures of the sea themselves, not just like the whale. They're creatures of the sea who live there for years, make the sea their home. At one lovely passage, Melville writes that they sleep, the Nantucketeer sleeps, while under his pillow, and now I quote, rush herds of walruses and whales. America's promise, as I said, then and now, from a kind of political or ideological point of view, is democracy. And this is a book that tries to be democratic. It's a book where rank and class and hierarchy no longer matter, at least in the traditional sense. So that on this boat, the whaling boat, the Pequod, you now have sailors from all over the world of different colors, different stripes, living together on this boat. Now, I don't want to overstate this. It's democratic in the sense that it's kind of a rainbow boat. On the other hand, let's not forget, a boat is an extraordinarily vertical proposition. It's a hierarchical proposition, and it has a captain who rules over it. It has first mate, second mate, third mate, etc. So there's no question that it is not entirely kind of egalitarian setup. Another point that Melville does not make, but that readers since have made, is that it so happens that there are no women on this boat. And you could argue, well, what kind of broad swath could you have for a kind of writing about the American sort of people if you have no women on your boat? I'm going to digress for just a moment. Wonderful comment made by the great American literary critic, Leslie Fiedler, who once said that all of the great American novels belong on the children's shelf. He said, only in American literature will your classics be books where there are no women, where two guys go out on a raft. He's thinking of Huckleberry Finn. And he says, there's not one major American text that can even speak intelligently or dares to speak intelligently about sex between men and women. And it's a provocative remark. You know, that there, you've got Walden. Some guy goes into, you know, a cabin that he makes and lives there. That it's as if adult love seems to be off limits for the American imagination. Well, that's something I'm not going to resolve that one because it's irresolvable. But I want you to think about it just a little bit when we trot out the notion that Moby Dick is a sort of democratic full book, which I believe there's still a lot that's not in it. Well, we don't start with Ahab, who is the kind of larger-than-life captain of this book. We start instead with Ishmael, who was the novel's great narrator. I call him great because I think he's a real triumph. He's feisty. He's got a kind of remarkable voice. And he's the one who takes us from beginning to end. He's the one who survives the wreck of the Pequod and who lives to tell the tale. He's jaunty, he's lively, he's engaging, he's plain-speaking, he's bluff. But he's also a bit more complex than that. I think it's fair to say that he's also prone to depression. He's the one who says it. He once says early in the book that when he finds himself pausing in front of coffin warehouses or finds that he's joining funeral processions, he realizes it's time to go to sea. And you get the sense that there's a kind of therapeutic dimension to this book, that he's out there to solve his own problems as much as to be the conduit for this larger story. One of the most endearing early scenes in Moby Dick is when Ishmael first meets Queequeg. Queequeg is going to be the harpooner, one of the harpooners on the boat, but it's a friendship that is going to be very important. How it begins, however, is a series of comic errors. Ishmael has gotten his room in Nantucket, that's where they meet, quite late, and is told that he'll have to share a bed with someone. This apparently is not bizarre at this moment in time. But he has no idea who it is, and he certainly doesn't know that it's going to be this rather strange, exotic South Sea Islander, a man who also happens to be filled with tattoo marks, and essentially a kind of figure that Ishmael has never seen before. So there's Ishmael lying in bed, it's late at night, and all of a sudden into the room comes this man who has no idea that Ishmael is lying in that bed. He comes in with a tomahawk and a wooden idol, and he's making these strange guttural noises, and Ishmael is understandably terrified, thinks that he's getting ready to be murdered. And so he screams, and Queequeg is making these noises, "Who devil you?" He screams, and the landlord comes into the room and tells him not to worry. It's only Queequeg. He wouldn't harm a hair on your head. At that point, Ishmael takes a closer look, and he sees that this is, in fact, a rather comely savage underneath these fierce markings. Melville writes quite wonderfully about that. This is Ishmael's sort of dawning perception that things are not so bad. Better sleep with a sober cannibal than a drunken Christian. Better sleep with a sober cannibal than a drunken Christian. A lot of Melvillian malice and wit is in that phrase, it seems to me. Here we see a white sailor sharing a bed with a dark-skinned man. And in fact, when they wake up, we learn from Melville's language, "You had almost thought I had been his wife." We today would regard this encounter as multiculturalism, people from different races not only understanding each other, but experiencing a kind of intimacy. And it speaks for, in fact, the growing relationship that will take place in the novel. The connection between Ishmael and Queequeg is one that lasts throughout the book, and it leads into the larger theme of connection itself. One of the chapters, which is called Monkey Ropes, describes the complex set of ropes that hold seamen as they descend into the bodies of these enormous whales that are suspended, and they go into the bodies of these whales to excavate. But they're held by ropes, and there are usually two of them. One is holding the other, who is down there, and Ishmael and Queequeg are connected that way. Melville actually uses the language of Siamese twins. And then he begins to think about this, and I'm evoking the scene because it's absolutely emblematic for the way Melville writes, for the way this man's mind works. We're starting with an extremely finite scene here. One man sort of tied by a rope to another who is descending into the body of this whale. It does sound exotic, but yet it's a very practical scene in terms of how the boat works. But it's not going to only be practical for Melville, because Ishmael realizes that this kind of bondage, this kind of connection, has extraordinary repercussions, ramifications. As he thinks about it further and further, this kind of, he calls it a Siamese ligature that unites them. He thinks of Queequeg as his twin brother. And then he uses a larger term, a joint stock company of two. He says, that's what my individuality had now become, a joint stock company of two. And then he's still in Melville. Once this thinking starts, once these gears start to turn, nothing can stop it. It keeps going. And so he begins to think about the relevance, the extraordinarily wide-ranging relevance of this perception for all of us. Not just folks on a whaling ship where one is holding another going down into a whale, but for all of us. And I'll just give you one of the most choice examples of it. If your banker breaks, you snap. If your apothecary by mistake sends you poison in your pills, you die. And what he's saying is, in every walk of life, in everything we do, we are interdependent, interconnected in ways that we rarely see. And it's important to bear this in mind, that there is almost a kind of ecological vision in this book, that we are all part of a kind of field picture, and that our own agency, hegemony, our own individual maneuvering room is always curtailed, always conditioned. It turns out that we're linked in ways that we rarely can measure. And the rich, expansive quality of Melville's imagination is to take these kinds of homely scenes, like monkey ropes, and to turn them into a metaphor that's really quite philosophical in character. Another one of those moments will be when he talks about fish. He talks about fast fish and loose fish. Fast fish, fast doesn't mean speed here. It means fish that belong to an owner. And loose fish would be fish that are fair game. And these are terms that fishermen and whalers need to know about. Once again, Melville is going to operate his own kind of magic on these terms and think about what their repercussions are, what their fuller dimensions might be. And so it goes a little bit like this. What are the sinews and souls of Russian serfs and Republican slaves but fast fish? In other words, if you're a serf or a slave, you're a fast fish. Somebody else owns you. What to the rapacious landlord is the widow's last mite but a fast fish? So now he's getting at the economic system itself that the landlord controls, owns the poor widow. What is the Archbishop of Save Souls' income of £100,000 seized from the scant bread and cheese of hundreds of thousands of broken-backed laborers? What is that globular £100,000 but a fast fish? You begin to see the reach of this figure. What about loose fish? What was America in 1492 but a loose fish? At least that's what Columbus made it for. What was Poland to the Tsar? What Greece to the Turk? What India to England? He's talking about colonialism. He's talking about possession. He's talking about politics. What at last will Mexico be to the United States? All loose fish. Well, why stop with that? What all men's minds and opinions but loose fish? What are you, reader, but a loose fish and a fast fish, too? And what's this lecture that I'm giving? It's a fast fish from my point of view, because I own it. I hope it becomes a loose fish, that you might take it, walk away with it, do something with it. That's the kind of ever-expanding Melvillian imagination. It takes things, and then it takes them, then it takes them, then it takes them still further, moving further and further outward in concentric circles, making us realize how lazy our minds are, how narrow our apprehension of things is. When I said he's generous, when I said he's robust, that's what I had in mind. There's a kind of, I don't even want to say intellectual, there's a kind of almost spiritual, philosophical muscularity in Melville. The things that we know move further and further out towards things we don't know. The original title of this book is called Moby Dick or the Whale. And I've always said when I talk about this book that whales do not strike me as particularly exciting or meaningful animals to talk about. I mean, I know they're great big, kids like to see them and everything, but I can't see them as somehow provocative. Well, they are. They are certainly for Melville. One reason that they were for Melville is that petroleum itself was only discovered in 1859, 8 years after this book was written, so that therefore whale oil had an enormous economic significance for American society, and particularly the industrial society. And America was the unquestioned world leader in this field, and Melville's very proud about that. He wants to beat his breast and say, look, we Americans are leading the world in that. There were 700, this is Melville's data, I have not checked him. He claims there were 700 American whaling vessels out there. It was the world's largest fleet. It was worth $20 million, Melville's figures. It brought in annually $7 million in income, Melville's numbers. Well, this book, there's a term that we call cetology, which is the science of whales. In this book, if you don't like whales, you're not going to like Moby Dick. And let's put that differently. If you're not willing to think about liking whales, you're not going to like Moby Dick, because the book's going to try to persuade you that whales are about the most fascinating creatures in the world. This book gives you more knowledge than you could ever have imagined, than you would probably ever want about whales. Much of it is anatomical. We get lots of descriptions, many weights and measures about the huge scale of whales, but we also get close-grained descriptions as well. That Ishmael is awed by the whale's body, and he's awed. He tries to describe the whale's tail. And of course, being Melville, this comes into something much more suggestive and enigmatic, like a sign system. The strange design of this tail seems to perhaps represent, symbolize something else. And if we can understand, perhaps, the tail, could we possibly ever understand the whale's face? And you begin to realize you're dealing with a very old notion, like looking at the face of God, that the face of this whale, you can't take its measure. If the whale's physical sort of mass and bulk defy our measures, its background is richer still, its history. It has a pedigree in both myth and legend. Melville tells us that the old stories we know about St. George, like St. George and the Dragon, or Perseus or Hercules, where they're all fighting with dragons, he said, oh, no, those weren't dragons. If we think about it, they were probably whales, huge creatures, larger than life creatures, And he tries to make a case that whales were already there, inserted in myths that we think we know. Might the whale be the Sphinx of the sea? Melville cites Job, he cites Alfred the Great, he cites Edmund Burke, the British historian. He goes on to the gods and to the legends. He talks about Jonah, he talks about Hindu mythology. In all of these places, he can find whales. He's obsessed, Melville is, with the metaphorical reach and scale of whales, the way in which they configure the Godhead, but also, and this is perhaps more interesting to us, they figure the dimensions of yearning and belief. They are inhabitants of the depths. They offer, in fact, for Melville, an image of the human soul, unplumbable, living in the deep, having secrets that we want to know. And they suggest, therefore, which is what the whole book is suggesting, the arduous but exciting trip necessary to get there, to reach it, to sound it, to take its measure. Those are the adventures of this book. Ishmael seeks to date the whale's history, and he gives us some remarkable lines. He says that you can't do this because the whale is older than history. It precedes time. It precedes human beings. When we started marking time, I quote, "I am horror struck at this anti-mosaic, unsourced existence of the unspeakable terrors of the whale, which having been before all time, must needs exist after all human ages are over." It's a line that has a kind of unintended irony for us. We know that whales are almost endangered species, and yet Melville makes this marvelous sort of prophecy. They pre-existed humans, they will outlive humans as well. But he also talks about the whale in terms of him being a kind of occupant of the vast reaches of the world. They are creatures of the depths of thinking and of feeling, not just of the ocean, and therefore they have a kind of grandeur to them. And Melville's prose rises to the challenge. Listen to this. He, this being the whale, he swam the seas before the continents broke water. He once swam over the site of the Tuileries, you know, the great gardens in Paris, and Windsor Castle, and the Kremlin. In Noah's flood, he despised Noah's ark. So here is this godlike creature whose dominion seems to be the entire world because there's far more water than land, and he is the great ruler. It's clear enough that the depths are going to be the area that fascinates Melville. And one of the notions that comes across in this book is the analogy between the depths of the sea and the depths of the soul, and then depths that are, in a sense, more everyday, which are the depths of human thinking. All deep, earnest thinking is but the intrepid effort of the soul to keep the open independence of her sea. That stamps, it seems to me, the flavor and character of this book. The sea represents depths. It represents everything that is beyond the surface world that we think confines us, that we think constitutes our knowledge. Whether it's the surface of our skin, which doesn't allow us to see the soul that lives inside of the human being, whether it's the surface of the physical world, like the surface of the ocean. He wants to go down. This is a book about plumbing. Plumbing not in the sense of, you know, pipes, but plumbing in the sense of sounding the depths, going deeper and deeper. And this is larded, I think, with a certain kind of anxiety as well. To go into the depths, as all of us know, is not necessarily a fun trip. You may discover things that you do not like. It may not be easy to get there. And there is, in Melville as well, a kind of deep, I think never satisfied, yearning for something that might be at the bottom, or something that might be in this great ocean, but could be a place of peace and harmony and serenity. This is how he says that. "For as this appalling ocean surrounds the verdant land, so in the soul of man there lies one insular Tahiti, full of peace and joy, but encompassed by all the horrors of the half-known life." It's this insular Tahiti that one wants to reach, but you don't reach it unless you have ventured into the depths, have entered into the ocean. A last sort of epithet, adjective for Melville that I'd like to give you is, amid the tornadoed Atlantic of my being. What a remarkable self-description. The tornadoed Atlantic of my being. He knows about the chaos, the distress, the restlessness, the curiosity, the blues, the depression that are part of his mindset and his soul set, and that he calls the tornadoed Atlantic of his being. And the quest is to acknowledge that and go through that to find either this insular Tahiti or to find some kind of what he calls eternal mildness of joy. We'll see how that works out in the next lecture. Moby Dick is not exactly a figure of joy. Thank you.